Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with questions surrounding Natalia Veselnitskaya, the Russian attorney who met with Donald Trump Jr., who was the same attorney representing the accused in a civil forfeiture case involving the money laundering of $230 million stolen from the Russian Treasury, which ended up in Manhattan real estate. Jenna McLaughlin, a reporter and blogger covering surveillance and national security at Foreign Policy magazine, joins us to discuss her article at Foreign Policy, DOJ Settled Massive Russian Fraud Case Involving Lawyer Who Met With Trump Jr. We'll investigate why President Trump fired the Manhattan U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara just before he went to trial with this case, after which the Justice Department under Jeff Sessions settled the case for $6 million instead of $230 million. On Wednesday, 17 Democratic congressmen on the House Judiciary Committee wrote to Sessions expressing their concern that DOJ, quote, may have settled the case at a loss for the United States in order to obscure the underlying facts. Then we'll examine further what looks like a massive cover-up by the Trump administration of a brazen Russian money laundering scheme that the Attorney General Jeff Sessions settled at a huge loss after Donald Trump had fired the U.S. attorney prosecuting the case, using the firing of all of the U.S. attorneys as a cover at the time. Lisa Graves, a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, joins us to discuss how even the Russian attorney representing the Russian crooks who met with Trump Jr., Natalia Veselnitskaya, was surprised at how generous Jeff Sessions' settlement was. Then finally, we'll try to figure out why the new French President Emmanuel Macron is giving Donald Trump the red carpet treatment, hosting a leader who is unpopular in France for what looks like an extended photo op. An expert on French politics and the French Socialist Party, Philippe Malliere, a professor of French and European politics at University College London, joins us to discuss the French reaction to Trump's sexist behavior. With his wife Melania, who is 25 years younger than he is, at his side, Trump commented crassly on first meeting France's first lady, who was 25 years older than her husband, "You're in such great shape." And joining us now is Jenna McLaughlin, who is a reporter and blogger covering surveillance and national security at Foreign Policy magazine and previously at Mother Jones magazine as an editorial fellow. Her latest article at Foreign Policy is DOJ Settled Massive Russian Fraud Case Involving Lawyer Who Met With Trump Jr. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jenna McLaughlin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jenna, it does seem like lots of dots are being connected now since Donald Trump Jr. was forced to release the email chain that's very incriminating. Clearly the New York Times had it, and he tried to get out ahead of them.
Absolutely.
But it does seem that this lawyer, Veselnitskaya, the more you know about her, the more horrible she is, frankly. I spoke with Bill Browder, whose lawyer, Magnitsky, was murdered in a Russian prison. And, of course, she has been defending the people who were involved in that and who stole $230 million of tax money that Browder was paying the Russian Treasury, and they laundered that money through real estate in New York. And even now, I'm being told that she's actually an FSB or an SVR officer. So let's start with that. Have you heard any rumors about whether or not the lawyer, Veselnitskaya, is in fact a Russian intelligence officer?
I hadn't heard that rumor specifically yet. That's very interesting to me, just because she seems to be appearing in the middle of all these different areas. And I think the name is coming up, and now different areas of the government as well as Congress are able to sort of connect these dots, like you said. Obviously, we're seeing her come up again in this case that you just mentioned, and she is saying, you know, we got this incredibly generous settlement 2 days before the case was supposed to start. She's surprised about it. And you have to wonder, you know, why is that? Is there something else going on here?
Well, let's get into that then. The case was being prosecuted by Preet Bharara, right? The U.S. attorney who was fired after Donald Trump had promised to keep him on the job. He was fired. And then a lot of I think all of the U.S. attorneys were fired en masse. The rumor there again is that the Trump administration effectively fired all the U.S. attorneys as cover for firing Preet Bharara. But let's start with what Preet Bharara was doing in terms of these defendants in this case, this money laundering case that Natalia Veselskaya was their attorney for.
Right. So he brought this case in 2013, and at the time he described it as a significant step towards uncovering and unwinding a complex money laundering scheme arising from a notorious foreign fraud. So this was a really big case for Bharara and New York. He heralded it, one of his big wins, as an important notch in his belt. And he actually was fired kind of prior to this case being brought, or the case being settled. But he, like James Comey, who was fired as FBI director, said that the president asked him for an oath of loyalty that he wasn't willing to give.
And do we know what transpired then in that earlier discussion with Trump and Bharara, where Trump apparently promised Bharara his job? Was that when he sort of reached out to him in the same way that he reached out to Comey?
I believe so. That's how I understand it. And Mr. Bharara has been pretty vocal about that since, saying, you know, that's not the job of the U.S. attorney. There should be independence there. And he actually did attend Mr. Comey's public testimony in Congress and was there to sort of support him. Mm-hmm. So the two have had kind of a parallel storyline.
But again, the case was pretty solid, was it? I mean, what do we know about the case that Sessions settled suddenly?
It was pretty well established in the case that $230 million had been laundered through Manhattan real estate. The case seemed pretty open and shut, as far as I can tell. I hadn't done kind of extensive research into it previously, besides obviously its impact on the Magnitsky Act, which is something that Russia's been interested in and trying to get rid of those sanctions, essentially, the sanctions that are really strict on them.
And again, I'm speaking with Jenna McLaughlin, who is a reporter and blogger covering surveillance and national security at Foreign Policy magazine. She previously was at Mother Jones magazine as an editorial fellow, and her latest article at Foreign Policy is DOJ settled massive Russian fraud case involving lawyer who met with Trump. So I talked to Bill Browder a few days ago when this story was just sort of breaking about the lawyer, and he, needless to say, didn't have any kind words to say about her. He really feels that she's got a lot of blood on her hands. So to that extent, do you detect the kind of layer of sleaze about this whole story with tacky celebrities and this extraordinary tabloid journalist from the UK who seems to be the go-between? Isn't there a kind of whiff here of sort of tackiness along with possible collusion with the Russians?
Yeah, you could certainly put it that way. And I think, honestly, as we see more and more of the story come forward, these stories about collusion with Russia, we're going to see more and more some of these lower-level people who may or may not have connections all the way up to the Kremlin sort of testing the waters. I think I've seen it posed. This particular lawyer may have come forward and said, you know, I might have some interesting information, but, you know, I'm coming from this person who works with celebrities. It's no big deal. It's very casual. We'll just have this conversation. And going towards someone in Trump's family might have just been kind of an initial way to set up a contact, to set up one of these back channels, which is something that we've seen before with other characters in the scene in Trump's team.
So, in other words, all of this to and fro in the press over whether she was, as Rob Johnson in the email said, she's a Russian government lawyer, and of course she said she's not, and they said that the email said she had dirt on Hillary, she said not, and then now they were saying, well, we were talking about orphans, which is a confusion about the Magnitsky Act, because in a petulant fit of rage after the Magnitsky Act was passed by the Congress, Putin retaliated by preventing the adoption of Russian children, and in fact, you know, Russian children with serious problems who would otherwise nobody wanted, particularly the Russian authorities. So he acted in a very arbitrary and cruel way there. So, but you think the real possibility is that the meeting was basically to set up the channel as opposed to whatever the details of the meeting were?
It seems like it to me. I think that that's certainly something that the Kremlin would be capable of doing or might be interested in doing. And, you know, someone like Donald Trump Jr., he might not have access to all the information about that campaign, but it might be a way to just see, you know, how willing are the people in the Trump's team kind of invested in getting this kind of information? Are they going to come meet with us? Will we be able to set up phone calls in the future? And also, I mean, the fact that it's this lawyer who, you know, might have top-level Kremlin government contacts, might not, it serves to continue to fuel this idea of confusion, of chaos, of not really knowing what's what. And it's very easy for high-level politicians to kind of take advantage of that confusion and sort of eliminate stories and get away from the key points.
But again, going back to the kind of pantheon of tacky people in the background there that were mentioned, the singer, Emin Agalarov, his family, the father, of course, is a big real estate developer in Moscow, is often referred to as Russia's Donald Trump. He's supposedly close to the Kremlin. Emin was married to the daughter of the sort of kleptocrat who runs Azerbaijan, Aliyev, and Emin's mother, I believe, on his mother's side, the grandfather was a KGB lieutenant general, Vasily Shekhanovich. So again, I'm trying to sort of look into this further, the intelligence connections, the extent to which Veselskaya and the rest of them have ties to the intelligence services. But isn't that how Russia is today? I mean, you got a former KGB guy running the place. He's got the Siloviki, all of his cronies from the KGB, as the new oligarchs. Isn't there a pretty well-established relationship between the government and former intelligence people?
Absolutely. Like you pointed out, Putin himself is a former intelligence man, and you know he uses those skills every day, I believe. And in recent years, you know, you see this connection between high-level government officials and sort of this moneyed elite, and that might be a little bit less so now, but certainly still exists to an extent. And I think the other aspect of this as well is that the kind of tacky celebrityness is something that would be attractive to the Trump family. It's something they're familiar with. You know, you hear about this famous singer in a foreign country that wants to have contact with you, and you say, oh, you know, we speak the same language. Maybe this is the best way for us to kind of establish an initial conversation. At least that's kind of how I would see it.
So, Jennifer McLaughlin, back to your article at Foreign Policy, DOJ settled massive Russian fraud case involving lawyer who met with Trump Jr. We didn't finish sort of going through the case in the sense of how Sessions stepped in and suddenly settled this case. And the implication here, which is pretty clear, is that Trump fired Preet Bharara because he was getting too close to something that could blow up in his face. And he used the firing of all the U.S. attorneys as kind of cover for doing this. And then shortly thereafter, Sessions settled this money laundering case involving these Russian gangsters. And their lawyer, as you mentioned earlier, Veselskaya, who's famous or infamous now because of this meeting she took with Donald Jr., even she was surprised that the case was settled. So let's pick it up from where Preet Bharara was fired.
Sure. So Preet Bharara was fired, I believe, in March, and this case was settled in May. I'm almost positive. It was 2 days before the actual trial was slated to begin that the case was settled by Sessions. So we don't have details on why he did that. We have details on what the actual agreement was in the end. It was for $6 million instead of the $230 million that was laundered, and this did not require an admission of guilt, nothing like that. So it's really hardly even a slap on the wrist. You know, the lawyer said that she felt like it was almost like an apology from the American government, which is a pretty bold way to put it. And, you know, these Democratic congressmen from the House Judiciary Committee, they don't have these details either, but this is the reason that they wrote this letter. They say, you know, we write with some concern that two events may be connected and that the department may have settled the case at a loss to the United States in order to obscure the underlying facts. So they kind of attached a laundry list of questions that they're interested in, including, you know, what were the underlying reasons for settling this case two days before it was over? Was there any contact between the Justice Department, this Russian attorney, between the Trump campaign? Have there been conversations about this for a long time? Was it settled for any sort of political reasons? So we're certainly hoping that that kind of thing would be answered by the White House, but also another fact that's brought up in this letter is that, you know, this committee itself is waiting on, I think, 12 other responses to various letters that they've sent to the White House. So, I mean, we can't really feel like we can hold our breath on this one.
But this specifically is a letter by a number of Democratic congressmen on the House Judiciary Committee. They sent it both to the White House and to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, did they not, to ask him,
yes, they did.
Him directly, why did you settle this case, right?
They did, yes. So the letter was sent to both parties, and who knows if we're going to get a response on that anytime soon. It might be something that kind of gets buried again. But I don't expect that the House Judiciary Committee will let it go, although their Republican counterparts didn't sign on to the letter, so that's kind of an indication of their interest in the matter.
Well, that opens up a whole question, which is just mystifying as to why the Republicans are sticking by this guy who's increasingly embarrassing to the point. I mean, have you ever seen anything in the American political lexicon, if you will? I mean, it used to be the Republicans were the cold warriors during the Cold War. They often were going back to McCarthy days. They were the red baiters, the communist haters. And now they're all making excuses for Putin. And,
right.
and then on the left, you got people like Oliver Stone making excuses for Putin. So there's something crazy going on about what. Have you figured out why there's no outrage about what the Russians did?
So I think that that's probably pretty complicated, and I hope that we find out answers to that soon. It is pretty mystifying to me. I'm still a pretty young reporter, so I've kind of come up in this insane era, obviously less so when I was covering President Obama. But it's really fascinating. I mean, this isn't the only instance of seeing sort of direction from Republicans in the Senate and Congress and the House that are looking at sort of other issues like leaks and things like that, that they're saying are classified leaks. The Senate Republicans put out a report a couple weeks ago specifically naming journalists, including myself, who they say were a risk to national security because they'd written about stories from within the White House, and they didn't specify at all whether that information was classified or not, because in most cases, including mine, that information was not classified. And it are really just going after the journalists who are trying to get information from within the White House because there's really no transparency there. So we'll see if that support for the White House continues, if more stories like this come out.
But in general, my sense is that this whole story, obviously because of the focus on the Trump family and the Russian connections and so much resources being put into it, is that in this story about Donald Trump Jr., what's, I think, missing in terms of Veselnitskaya is the context which you've provided in your article at Foreign Policy, Jennifer McLaughlin. And you've got to go back to what really happened here, that this lawyer for Bill Browder was murdered in a Russian prison because he was the whistleblower that found a group of mid-level officials stole $230 million from the taxes that Bill Browder had paid to the Russian government. They literally stole it from their equivalent of the IRS and laundered some of this money via Manhattan real estate. I don't think anybody's made the claim that it was laundered through Donald Trump's many real estate ventures. But nevertheless, then this lawyer who shows up at Trump Tower is the lawyer defending these crooks who stole the money and laundered it and, of course, were responsible for Magnitsky's murder. And Magnitsky's murder, of course, prompted the U.S. Congress to sign the Magnitsky Act to sanction these very people. So was she representing people that were sanctioned under the Magnitsky Act?
I am not sure about that. And in this case, she was representing these companies specifically that had committed the fraud.
Mm-hmm. But they'd received this stolen money, had they not?
Right.
Right, and laundered it through Manhattan real estate.
Absolutely.
Well, look, let's stay in touch. Again, I see it as also as sort of more about sleaze and the kind of company that these Trump people are keeping. But
absolutely.
I guess there'll be more of that down the pike. So.
Right, and I mean, Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort knew about it, too. They were CC'd on the email, and they were in the meeting, too.
Right. And
not
that,
just
sure.
Trump Jr.
And then Donald Trump, what was it, a day later, when he finally secured the nomination for the Republican Party, he made those statements about, we've got some really hot information that I'm going to release soon about Hillary Clinton and her dirty dealings. I mean, you can't.
I think it was right when he said that he wanted, you know, Russia, if you've got access to these missing 33,000 emails or whatever it was, you know, you should release them. And people are connecting those, and there's no indication necessarily that he was inviting them to hack those emails or that he thought that they might have access to it, but it's not something that you can entirely eliminate from the realm of possibility.
Well, but the front page story in Thursday's New York Times is that the very contents of that email chain promising all this dirt, Trump the very next day made this campaign rally when he got the nomination promising that some dirt on Hillary was coming, which is exactly what the emails promised. So, I mean, that's pretty difficult not to connect the dots
there.
All righty. Well, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, Jenna.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jenna McLaughlin, who's a reporter and blogger covering surveillance and national security at Foreign Policy Magazine. And previously, she was at Mother Jones Magazine as an editorial fellow. And her latest article on foreign policy is DOJ settled massive Russian fraud case involving lawyer who met with Trump Jr. And we're going to take a brief station break and back, examining further what looks like a massive cover-up by the Trump administration of a brazen Russian money laundering scheme that Attorney General Jeff Sessions settled at a huge loss. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who is Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Chief Deputy for the U.S. Courts, and as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Nice to be on, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And given your work in the Justice Department, can you shed any light on why did Jeff Sessions settle this case for $6 million instead of $230 million? And on Wednesday, 17 Democratic congressmen on the House Judiciary Committee wrote to Sessions expressing their concern that the DOJ, quote, may have settled the case at a loss for the United States in order to obscure the underlying facts.
Well, I don't have any inside information from the Justice Department, but I do think that we are entitled to answers from Mr. Sessions himself about this case, and I really hope that that there will be answers, that he'll be forced to answer, that he'll be called up the Hill and he'll have to answer. I hope that the reporters keep asking him that question, because the American people have a right to know. They have a right to know why this case was settled, why it was basically settled for pennies on the dollar, and why it was settled in the time frame that was settled, as these concerns, deepening concerns about Russia and Russian entanglement with the Trump administration, with Trump and the Trump campaign continue to deepen.
But the fact that the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee didn't sign off on the letters, do you think it's going to get buried in this partisanship that's just extraordinary, the lengths to which Republicans are twisting themselves in knots and blinding themselves to the obvious about what's happening with this dysfunctional and even criminal gang of family kleptocrats and incompetents that are just driving this country off the cliff?
Well, I mean, I'm astonished by the Republican members on the Hill and their continued action to put party loyalty ahead of loyalty to our nation. I think it's a very serious, very troubling situation that has arisen. This cult of personality around Trump, the effort to defend him, to turn a blind eye to extremely serious matters is quite frankly appalling. And you see it time and time again. I think this week you've seen a letter or statement by Senator Grassley, the Iowa Republican, who is basically trying to lay blame at the Obama administration for whether the woman at issue in this particular situation with Donald Trump Jr. was let into the country and didn't register as a foreign agent. And so rather than actually investigate the underlying issues, actually investigate the real issues, or join in a bipartisan letter to Mr. Sessions asking him for a full disclosure of what happened as in this settlement of this particular other case that you mentioned, that's what Mr. Grassley is busy doing. And so we see this time and time again. We see Republicans basically dodging the real issues that our nation is facing, real issues that the intelligence community and the intelligence agencies have raised. And, for example, with regard to the evidence of Russia's intention and actions to tamper with the integrity of our election process. And so I, as a citizen of this country, am appalled that these Republican leaders, so-called leaders in Congress, continue to try to aid and abet Trump and the Trump administration and evade actually doing their duty to protect us, the American people, in this circumstance.
Well, you know what Grassley's planning to do? He's got a hearing, I think, coming up next week, where, and the Republicans are trying to do this, they want to create the fiction that the Steele memo was actually created by Russian intelligence in order to discredit Donald Trump so that it's an equal opportunity thing. It wasn't just that the Russians wanted to dig up dirt and hurt Hillary Clinton. They also dug up dirt and wanted to hurt Donald Trump. That's how they're trying to play it.
Yeah, I read that. I read that, Ian, and I have to say that one of the things that the advent of the Trump administration and these willing aiders and abettors on the Hill has revealed to me is that I lack the imagination necessary to really even understand the sorts of twists and turns, the gymnastics, the mental gymnastics that they are willing to engage in to try to distort public perception and public opinion. I can't even... I really couldn't even imagine that would be the course that this would take. If I had unlimited funds, which I don't, I would actually be spending time getting information out to every VFW meeting place in the country, every veterans association in the country to say, please stand up and speak out. Do you not understand what these men in this administration, what this administration is doing in terms of our national security? I'm concerned that there's a portion of the American population that isn't getting actual information, real information about these crises. And instead is being spun, this sort of disinformation, just like you point out, this effort to try to twist this coming hearing into some sort of indictment of the Obama administration versus actually looking into what is on the surface here, which is the real story, which is this extraordinarily unprecedented effort by Putin and Russia to tip the scales, to put their thumb on the scales of our election, our sacred democratic trust, in essence, to install Trump in the White House.
So just going back to, the letter that we talked about that one Wednesday, 17 Democratic congressmen on the House Judiciary Committee wrote to Sessions expressing their concern that the DOJ, quote, may have settled the case at a loss for the United States in order to obscure the underlying facts. And that certainly seems to me to be something that we really need to find out about. But there's so much suspicion surrounding this because Preparara, apparently, Donald Trump had told the Manhattan U.S. attorney that he wanted to keep him on And then he decided to fire him. And a lot of people believe that he fired all of the U.S. attorneys just to cover the fact that he really wanted to fire Preet Bharara. And then, then what, 2 days before this case went to trial, Sessions settles for pennies on the dollar. So what do you think happened here? I mean, it just looks so damn suspicious to me.
Well, it really does. You know, this question of the U.S. attorneys and the firing, it comes at an extraordinary point in our country in terms of having those offices not filled by a Senate confirmed leader in those top prosecution offices in the various states and federal districts within the country. And obviously, the news has come out a couple months ago that Mr. Bharara was told by Trump that he was not going to be asked to resign his post. Typically, the U.S. attorneys, who were appointed by a prior president, will resign and they'll be replaced by other U.S. attorneys. But in this case, you had a circumstance in which Mr. Bharara was told he was not going to be one of those who would be asked to leave his position. And that happens sometimes from administration to administration. In fact, it's what's happened to the current Deputy Attorney General of the United States. He was appointed in one administration and stayed on into the next administration. And so in this case, I think it is suspicious, this timing, that the change in decision about getting rid of Bharara. And I think at this point, it's very difficult for any reasonable person to trust any of the explanations given by Mr. Trump or by his attorney general for why they do anything. There's been such a record, such a pattern of deceit, obstruction, of, you know, not telling the truth, of not being forthcoming. In the case of Mr. Trump, I mean, it's basically happening on a daily basis, but even with Mr. Sessions. And so, the timing of his firing, I think, is very troubling. The circumstances of it as well, and especially with cases like this pending, there was also, you know, some indication that Mr. Bharara was looking into other issues that might implicate the Trump company or Trump associates.
But then when you find, as our previous guest suggested, that perhaps this meeting with the Russian attorney, who was billed as a Russian government attorney, was, and that some of the research I'm doing now indicates that she may well be an intelligence officer with the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service of the Russian Federation, that she might well have been meeting with Donald Trump Jr., Jared, and Manafort as a way to establish the very back channel, the channel that they needed to transact all of this stolen stuff from the DNC, which eventually was dumped on WikiLeaks. But my sense is that if the Russians went to the trouble of stealing the DNC's mail and real-time communications of the head of Hillary's campaign, John Podesta, which is obviously, if you're reading the other side's mail in a competition, you've got a massive advantage. I believe that they were getting that stuff in real time, not that it was just dumped later on by WikiLeaks. So, and we know that Jared went to the VNB bank to set up a back channel, and he met with the Russian ambassador, who couldn't believe that he was being asked to set up a secure private channel between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. So it seems to me that the fact that you've got this case that this lawyer represented that was mysteriously settled by Sessions, and it's the same lawyer that looks as if she was the emissary from the Kremlin to set up a intelligence channel to feed the Trump campaign all the stolen stuff that the Russian intelligence had stolen from both the DNC and from John Podesta.
I mean, I have to say, you know, no one could really write this plot. I think Stephen King may have had some comments on it, sort of as a master of fiction, who would imagine this. But, you know, in this instance, as you point out, it is the same attorney, Natalia Veselnitskaya. And, this is a situation in which it is clear on the surface of the emails, in the direct and plain language of the emails, that the meeting was described as part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. It was described as providing, you know, providing incriminating information about Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump's son for the Trump campaign to use. And as many of your listeners know, Donald Trump Jr. responded by saying, "I love it. That's great. He can't wait to meet," basically. And he wants to make sure the timing of the release of the information is later in the summer to do maximum damage. And, you know, in this instance, you know, on the surface of it, just the plain language that was used, the purpose of the meeting is damning. Donald Trump Jr.'s response is damning. And it wasn't just his response. He used that solicitation to go to Paul Manafort, who was then the chairman of the campaign, the leader of the election campaign for Mr. Trump, to go to Mr. Manafort and go to Jared Kushner, the closest other advisor to Mr. Trump, and get them in a meeting with her. In the meantime, as this meeting is being set up, Mr. Trump himself is promising that you'll soon see incriminating information about Hillary Clinton. And shortly thereafter is actually when the first round of leaks from the DNC, the hacked emails from the DNC, start being put out into the public realm. And then later in the summer, as you know, is when Trump basically, in his own words, said it'd be great if the Russians would provide, you know, all the emails that were part of Hillary Clinton's server. And then if you fast forward, as you point out, to post-election, one of the very first things that Jared Kushner does is try to set up this so-called secure back channel through the Russian ambassador to the United States to communicate outside of the proper channels, outside of the channels of the White House, of the intelligence community of the United States of America, so that he can communicate and the Trump campaign can communicate with Russia on channels that are not actually secured from, you know, for the sake of the American people. They're secured from being listened to by our intelligence agency because they would be provided by their intelligence agencies, Russia. And so, you know, between this and everything else we've seen, this isn't even getting into the whole issue of Mr. Flynn, and everything else we've seen, it's damning. And quite frankly, I should add, you know, under U.S. campaign finance law, it is illegal to accept a donation from a foreign national. Sure. It certainly would be legal to accept a donation, a financial donation from the president of the Soviet Union, pardon me, a president of Russia, I should say. It would be illegal to accept a gift, meaning something of value, meaning opposition research on your opponent would be illegal to accept. And yet that there's no hesitation by Donald Trump Jr. to take this meeting and pursue this.
Sure. Well, Lisa, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here. And let's stay in touch because I think you're right that the press, the Republicans aren't going to do anything, but the press have got to shame Sessions into letting us know why he settled this case.
Yep. Yes. Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief for the U.S. courts, and as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department. And we're going to take a brief station break and back, try to figure out why the new French President Emmanuel Macron is giving Donald Trump the red carpet treatment.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College London. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philippe Mallier.
Hello.
Hello, Philippe. And can you figure out why Macron, the French president, newly installed with a surprise victory in both the presidency and in the assembly, a brand new party that he put together, why he is meeting with Donald Trump, who is deeply unpopular in France? And I believe already the appearance of Trump has dropped 10 points off Macron's approval rating. So why is he doing this, and what is he going to get out of it?
Well, absolutely. That took the French media, the French political circles by surprise, this invitation. Look, in the UK, Theresa May, who is having troubles following his this sort of early election, which he almost narrowly lost, is now thinking twice about inviting Trump. It was on the cards, and finally it's been postponed. So why would Macron now invite Trump, who, as you said, is not a very popular leader in not only in France but anywhere in Europe? It's a bit of a question. I think there are sort of very general and easy explanations. Probably he is, as you know, a very young statesman. First election, was never elected to any office before 39 years, and probably an attempt, that's an attempt here to invite, of course, the president of the US, one if not the major player in the world, in France, symbolically for the Bastille Day celebrations, marking, of course, the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789 on the 14th of July. The storming of the Bastille prison. So probably there's a lot of symbolism involved there, you know, putting himself on the map internationally. So meeting with Trump would be a way to be noticed, because Trump, I think that's only his third visit abroad since he was elected. So that would be a way. Now, the question is it an astute move on the part of Macron? I think there's a lot of talks in France today about that, and probably a lot of people beg to differ, because, again, the whole situation is that Macron probably would be more inspired to concentrate on European matters, because, of course, there's a major issue of the UK leaving soon the EU, Brexit. And Macron could sort of seize the opportunity to reestablish France's prominence in Europe and reestablish a stronger link with Germany, which has been lost somehow in the past years. He's not doing that. He prefers probably to be seen as the sort of one of the statesmen, or if not the statesman in the world, who is hosting Trump in Europe at least. And I think that's really my take on it, because Macron, as you also rightly said, is, although was elected largely against, that's the other irony, against his opponent was Marine Le Pen of the far right, Front National. Someone who, let's say it, you know, was supportive, or at least Trump said, had a very, very good words about Le Pen. And so it's a bit awkward to do that. On the face of it, I think the two men have very little in common politically, ideologically. So again, yes, my answer would be that's an attempt on the part of Macron really to say, well, I am the president of France, I'm young, but really don't snub me, don't take me for granted. France with me would be a major power again. And one of the things to do is simply to invite the US president, whoever it might be.
Well, of course, you know, in many ways, here in the United States, we have a similar situation, that the main parties are seem to be collapsing. The Democrats don't seem to have any focus and any platform, and they're just counting on this other guy, Trump, being impeached. And the Republicans are in disarray. There are more independents now registered in the United States than there are Republicans or Democrats. So there's a similar situation in France in the sense that that's how Macron came out of nowhere. But you could make the case that what the United States needs now is a kind of Macron, a new sort of centrist movement where disaffected Republicans and angry Democrats can find a voice. So it's almost, to my mind, that Macron is meeting with the enemy in political terms.
I quite agree with that, because clearly there is a strong, there's an argument to be made on Macron doing what I think no one ever did before in French politics, which is to literally create a real political center. There's a saying in French politics, and it is that the center doesn't exist. You either leaned a bit to the left or to the right. You're a center-right or center-left political party or politician. That's really the saying and the belief. Macron, who is by and large, and again, one needs to be a little bit impressionistic there and general, seems to be coming from the center-left, at least because he was a member of the Hollande government as Minister of the Economy. But he's shifted to the right, and now it is clear that his government and the parliamentary group in the National Assembly in France is clearly composed of people who come from both the left and right. That's really unheard of, unseen. You know, he's doing something new. We shall see whether it is a political experiment which will last, which will endure, and which will be successful. It's too early to say. But at least he's doing that, and that's new. So, although I take it that in the U.S. there's some similarities with the French case, with sort of traditional mainstream parties collapsing or at least being largely weakened. That's the case in France. Let's remember that the once dominating center-left party, the Socialist Party, has totally collapsed, and now it is pretty clear that he will not recover from it, which is absolutely sensational. The Republicans, not the U.S. one, but that's the name of the main conservative party in France, Juan Sarkozy's party, is also in disarray. So Macron seems to be the strong man, at least for now. So why would he again do business, or at least try to be friendly with a man who represents, at least from France, from Europe, the hard right? That's what how Trump is seen by political commentators and mainstream parties. The hard right, not a simple conservative, but the hard right. So it is, again, very puzzling. Again, it seems to me that Macron is sort of planning ahead his presidency. You know, it's a five-year term like in the U.S., hoping to be reelected again. There's no limitation to a third mandate in France. So he's young, so probably his sort of gamble is to think that he needs to establish himself on the international arena. So why not talk to Trump? Although, to be fair, look, there's one, for instance, subject. I understand they are discussing it as we speak, which is the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Accord climate change, which Trump announced a few weeks ago, which, of course, to the dismay of Europeans here, people could not believe that he did that. And so probably Macron is thinking, well, I'm going to do something good by trying to persuade President Trump to change his mind on this issue. And there were sort of rumors, you know, already tonight that Trump saying, that maybe it's not sort of a kind of final decision. He might reconsider, but that was very vague. So that's the sort of thing where you can, as a sort of centrist, justify a meeting with the most controversial hard-right president of the U.S., the most right-wing the U.S. has had probably since the end of the Second World War, and, you know, at least on a number of important dossiers such as climate change and the Paris Accord, I'm going to talk frankly to Trump in person and try to change his mind on that.
Well, Trump said in regard to the possibility of rethinking, pulling out of the Paris Accords, he said something could happen with the Paris Agreement. But he's famous for sort of teasing out sort of promises that never materialize. But I must say, though, what happened when he met with Macron for the first time with handshakes, and of course they'd had that awkward handshake before, but when Trump turns to Brigitte, Macron's wife, who's considerably older than he is, Trump comments, "You're in such great shape," before turning to Mr. Macron to repeat the same comment. And then, of course, immediately the First Lady Melania grabs Brigitte and pulls her away, like, you know, she knows her husband is crass. I mean, God, you know, we really have a pretty tacky bunch of family running this country. I mean, I guess in a way it's kind of an irony, isn't it, that Macron's wife is older than he is and Trump's wife is considerably younger, what we call a trophy wife over here. So what did you make of that extraordinary statement to Brigitte that she's in good shape?
Well, of course, the European media picks on that, of course. And no one was impressed, but what do you expect from Trump on that? It's, of course, totally sexist and in line with previous and worse statements than that. My personal take on it is that, you know, the sort of the gutter press in Europe, British, French and elsewhere, really made that point after the election or before, you know, the sort of age difference between Macron and his wife. The gutter press, you know, the tabloid press, the nasty press, and that's the level of the discussion in Europe. You just don't say that. It's utterly sexist, but also you just don't say that when you are in a public event, such as, you know, and on record, because of course that was heard and reported afterward by the media were around. So you just don't say that, and. But what do you expect? You know, we get to the point that one shouldn't be, unfortunately, one shouldn't be too surprised by the sort of comments. I think that Macron was probably not too impressed by it, but he's sort of used to that kind of, this is really the sort of mainstream politician wouldn't use that thing, wouldn't say such things here. It's not something you would do. But he did it, of course, and yes, that made a few headlines and tonight here. Yes, of course.
Well, at least he didn't. He used to rate women 1 to 10, so at least he didn't say, "Oh, you're a number 8 or a number 9." But tell me about the drop in the polls. That's pretty surprising, isn't it? Because I thought Macron was riding high. And did Trump really contribute to his sudden drop in the polls, or was there something else going on?
No, probably Trump has many flows, but not the one of, you know, coming to Paris and instantly as impacting so negatively on Macron. I don't think so. Although I don't think Macron is winning any points before the French voters and public by inviting Trump. To be fair, this is summertime here in Paris, so politics, you know, we had two very important elections in May and June. And the people are going on holiday now to the south, mostly of France, the French Riviera, and so on. So there's not much talk about politics. That's probably why you will sort of get away with it, essentially, because people are less aware of what goes on politically and less interested. But no, the drop in 10 points is for other reasons. And the reasons are, I think we need probably in sort of very briefly to get back to why Macron, why was he elected in the first place, which is the most sensational result in French politics of the past, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years. He shouldn't have been elected in the sense that if things had, you know, run as normal, you know, socialist French Republicans. But as you know, Hollande didn't run again. Then it's a left-winger who won the nomination for the Socialist Party, Benoît Hamon, and the right wing of the party deserted to support Macron. And then you had the Fillon candidate for the French Republicans, who was immediately, his candidacy was, imploded because of allegations of corruptions involving members of his family. So all that made it a very special election, and Macron was able to, by default largely, to gather together, you know, bits of the center-left, bits of the center-right. That's the sort of platform he's got now. Very strong numerically, because he's got a large majority in the House, but I don't think politically necessarily very strong, at least in the long run, because it's really by default, as I said. Mm-hmm. It's a coalition of people who didn't want to either vote for more left-wing candidates or for Le Pen. You know, 2 months on, he started his presidency not two months ago, and he's already seen as, you know, Hollande Mark II or Sarkozy Mark II.
Right.
You know, a bit of a continuation of all the same.
Sure.
Both presidents, remember, have been largely rejected by the electorate successively. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this man promised, you know, something radically new politics, is younger and so on. But in fact, you know, it's the same old failed policies which he's trying to force through. And I expect, you know, when the politics, you know, starts seriously again in the autumn, to have, you know, a very large opposition to his policy, because his platform is clearly on the right, it's neoliberal. So the idea that because you talk nicely about societal, cultural issues, you're on the left, that's not enough. By the way, when you're societal issues, Macron, there's a tension in his speech between, talks about equality when it comes to gender, race, and also human rights in general. But look, the issue of refugees. You may have heard that in the north of France, you know, a town called Calais, you know, which is a harbour town when you want to go
sure.
to the UK.
That's where all go to the UK, right, where the tunnel is. And
yes, absolutely.
There's a place called the jungle. We've pretty much run out of time, Philip.
Okay.
I just wanted to reinforce what you said about how unpopular taking on the unions and making it easy to fire people in France. But Trump weighed in support of that and said, we're both going to cut the bureaucracy. So there you have it. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College London. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.